couple of weeks ago, a jaw-dropping headline hit the wires. Disney was laying off 28,000 theme park workers in the United States. Few visitors were coming to Disneyland or Disney World, so the company needed to make cuts, even if that meant eliminating the jobs of people playing Donald, Mickey, or Goofy. Making matters worse has been the nagging closures of movie theaters, busting up Disney's potential box office returns. Sports ratings for ESPN aren't looking that healthy either. But, of course, it's not all bad news for Disney. The entertainment giant has been killing it with streaming. Disney Plus debuted last fall, almost a year ago, and it was a hit out of the box. And with everyone stuck at home during the pandemic, it's grown worldwide to more than 60 million subscribers. This contrast of the futility at theme parks and movie theaters with the surge in streaming makes Disney Plus an even more important business story. But inside Disney, the more important Disney Plus was, the more executives in the company fought to control it. And there's a lot at stake. This week, activist investor Dan Loeb urged Disney to dump billions of additional dollars into its streaming efforts to take on Netflix. This is The Information's 411. I'm Corey Weinberg, a reporter at The Information. My colleague and 411 co-host Tom Dotan has been breaking news on the behind-the-scenes streaming wars battles, and he'll join me in this episode to discuss. Then, in the back half of the episode, we turn to other hot news items: antitrust, sexism in tech, remote work, and tech culture itself. I interviewed Maël Gavet, a French-born former tech executive who worked in Russia and the US, for her perspective on all of these topics. She just wrote a book on tech's empathy problem. And if you'd like to read in-depth stories about big tech and accusations of its monopoly power and all that good stuff, we have some pieces you might like on theinformation.com this week. Amir Afradi and Nick Bastone wrote about why a Google Maps competitor thinks it has anti-competitive behavior. And Paris Martineau wrote about how Amazon is preparing earlier for the big holiday shopping season and how that's affecting merchants. But first, let's talk Disney and streaming with Tom. So, Tom, you cover the intersection of Hollywood and tech and write a lot about developments related to Disney. I thought it would be a good idea to kind of understand Disney's current moment, to take us back to 2015. You've written previously that the company was trying to kick its quote-unquote Netflix addiction. What was that all about?
So in 2015, there was a lot of debate inside the company over how much they should keep licensing. They had signed a deal with the company to give them access to a lot of their big movies, like from Marvel, later from Star Wars. It was a huge, huge contract, you know, big revenue for Disney. And, you know, people, even the CEO, Bob Iger, were very proud of the amount of money they were making off of Netflix. But at the same time, there were executives at the company who said, is this a good idea? We're basically giving our best stuff. It's reruns and we're getting money from it, but we're giving our best stuff to a company that could very easily be our competitor. So it all sort of comes to a head financially for Disney in 2015 when Bob Iger, in this earnings call, basically admits to the fact that everyone sort of knew at this point, which was that cord cutting, which is people stopping to pay for their cable subscription in favor usually of watching a streaming service like Netflix or nothing, that had picked up. And ESPN, which is this kind of profitable cash cow for the company, responsible for a huge amount of its profits, was losing subscribers. And that was going to be a problem for the company down the line. Now, Iger really tried to play it down at the time and say, you know, we are experiencing some modest sub losses. It's stuff that shouldn't be affecting us too much, you know, in the next 5 years, which is something that investors don't like to hear. When they suddenly saw this kind of issue with ESPN losing subscribers cropping up, they're like, oh, no. This is very bad. Disney is not as valuable as we thought it was. And it kind of kicked off this huge sell-off of Disney's stock.
Right. And so nothing to inspire change like a stock sell-off and a market cap cut.
It gave ammunition. It gave ammunition to people inside the company who were like, you see, this is a problem. We need to address it somehow. So, yeah, let's flash forward now to 2017, where, you know, Iger says, we have taken the step to build our own streaming service. And over time, the idea of this thing builds up momentum inside the company. And It ends up being its number one priority. Iger says this is the thing we need to make sure that we focus all of our attention on. And to help do that, he reorganizes the company so that the streaming division exists as a separate entity. It's not going to live inside the TV group. It's not going to live inside the studios group. This is going to be its own important thing.
It's a real time sort of case study in how are they trying to not become irrelevant, essentially, which was like a real possibility.
Yeah, it's this issue that has always bedeviled media companies, which is, do you want to put aside the short-term cash that you get from selling a show, or do you want to make sure that you can build your own in-house service? You may not get all the cash from it, but you're helping to build up, you know, this new product. And I mean, this even went down to just the way people were compensated, right? If you're compensated based on how much money you bring into the company, well, you're going to be incentivized to try to sell more stuff. As part of this restructuring that Iger did, he also changed the compensation structure for people at Disney so that, you know, you didn't have this issue of executives saying, let's just take the quick money fast.
Right. And meanwhile, Disney was also, you know, it was bulking up its content. It, you know, famously bought, you know, had bought Marvel and Star Wars and 20th Century Fox. And Disney Plus launched pretty successfully, right?
They had a huge out-of-the-gate hit with this thing. 10 million subscribers after day one. I mean, it was so popular, the service crashed.
All that success, of course, breeds internal politics. Kind of a good kind of politics. I don't know. Something's working, but the people at the top of the company want to make sure that they are seen as sort of contributing to the success of Disney Plus, right? So you focused on sort of the behind the scenes jostling this week. Set up this fight for us. What's going on?
Kevin Mayer is the executive that Iger put in charge of the streaming division. And the other side of this story that I wrote about is Peter Rice, who is the head of the TV networks and the TV studios, like the organization that makes the content that fills the TV networks. And he is also making shows for Disney Plus. Their studios are making stuff like the High School Musical movie reboot and Phineas and Ferb the movie and those kinds of things. And Peter Rice's argument is, we believe that we should be in control of which shows that we make that go onto the streaming service. And Kevin Mayer's argument is, the streaming service is under our division and it's coming out of our budget. And if a show does well, it's going to help us. And if it bombs, it's going to hurt us. So it should absolutely be our strategy to control which shows that you make end up on the streaming service. And it's this whole fight over essentially control, right? Who really gets to control the content and the programming on this initiative that the CEO has declared as the most important. And as a side point to it, I mean, what this really is about, especially if you are in, you know, the Peter Rice camp, is it's about the future. And you are basically wanting to be as close to this entity that is where the company is going to go for the next couple of maybe decades. And, you know, if you're at Disney retreats, Disney offsites every year, the company has, you know, like a retreat at Disney World or Disneyland, you want to be in the group of people that is associated with the streaming group and has as much influence as possible, because then you're part of the cool kids.
And obviously Kevin Mayer now departed, you know, bring us, you know, kind of forward to today. What are kind of like the current, you know, sort of politics within Disney streaming?
Kevin Mayer leaves Disney in May to take this ill-fated stint as the CEO of TikTok. And so that opens up this kind of power vacuum at the company because he was a very powerful executive who was able to kind of build the organization in the way that he wanted and kind of get his way. And he has a replacement who is a longtime Disney, you know, an old hand at Disney, but she's also maybe not someone who is going to be as willing to fend off you know, the arguments that that Peter Rice's group is making. So as I understand it, you know, this is an ongoing issue. It has not been fully resolved. And it actually is possible in the next couple of weeks we finally see some sort of announcement from the company as part of a reorganization that could kind of deal with this matter specifically.
All right, Tom. Well, thanks so much. This is a fascinating development, and it's a real, you know, kind of, like I said, case study and disruption. It's fascinating.
Yeah, no, if you're a media company, you do not want to give up your shot.
I'm joined now by Mael Gavay, a former tech executive who just wrote a book that's quite relevant for this moment. It's called Trampled by Unicorns: Big Tech's Empathy Problem and How to Fix It. Mael, thanks for joining us.
Hi, pleasure to be here.
So your book was really interesting. It weaves in your experiences in tech with a deep overview of the ethical concerns that you have with how U.S. startups and big tech companies have built their products and their culture. But you come at the topic from a global perspective. You're European, you were born in Paris, in the Paris suburbs, worked at BCG, and eventually went on to run one of the first e-commerce companies in Russia called Ozon. And most recently, you were an executive at the real estate tech unicorn Compass and at the travel giant Booking Holdings. I was curious, how do you think your experiences growing up and working not in the U.S., informed your view on U.S. technology culture and product development?
And I did live and work in Russia at a time where they were starting to think about whether the internet was an actual strategic asset for the government and something that needed to be defended. And I was in Russia when in 2014 or 15, I can't remember, the Russian government for the first time explained that data of Russian citizens should actually be stored in Russia. And so to me, it's been really an interesting journey to look at how countries are tackling the same problem, but from very different angles based on their history, and how tech companies in the US tend to overlook some of these differences and somehow think that the US way is systematically the right way. And I think that, to go back to the title of my book, it kind of shows a little bit a lack of empathy, which doesn't mean that it should be sympathy, but I think like trying to really understand, especially when you're a global company, how citizens and governments around the world are going to react to the things that you do, the products that you launch, is actually quite important if you want your business to still be around 50, 100 years from now.
So you were an executive at Booking Holdings, which is one of the largest advertisers on Google search. It relied on Google to grow, and yet Google is also in the travel game. It provides an on-ramp for people to book flights and hotel rooms and vacation rentals. So as an online travel executive, did you ever think, man, Google should be really broken up?
I don't know if it was because I was wearing my hat of EVP of operation of that group at the time, but it's more as a citizen, as a consumer, as a human being. To me, there is something fundamentally debatable, if not questionable, around the fact that we have companies that can or are more powerful than an democratically elected government. I think to me, that was the problem. And that is still the problem. And that was part of the reason why I wrote in my book an entire chapter about antitrust. I don't believe that antitrust is this kind of universal, one-size-fits-all solution and we need to apply it across the board. I think we have to be very careful about the fact that these companies actually provide really good services. I think we need to be careful about the fact that technically speaking, there are some breaking up which are just not possible. Like, how do you break up search for Google, as I hear sometimes non-tech people talk about? And so I think there's definitely a lot of nuances to be taken into consideration. But at the same time, it is so obvious that our current antitrust legislation, especially in the US, is not adapted to this new business model that is not taking power from distribution, from owning physical assets like it used to be the case with legacy businesses, and it's more around data and network effects. And so I think we need absolutely to have conversation around the new legislation that is required.
I want to move from policy into diversity, tech culture, the empathy topic. Sexism still apparently runs rampant inside of prominent tech firms. Another French tech executive, Francois Bruget, recently sued Pinterest, where she was COO. The prominent startup Carta has faced similar allegations of discrimination. What has been your experience as a woman in tech?
I think it's an experience that is maybe a little different because I worked all over the world and I I experienced it not just with American companies, but also outside of the US. And in general, to me, it was a broader question, not just about women, but about minorities. So not just the sexism that you refer to, but what it is to be one of a kind in the room, be because of your age, your race, your gender, your sexual orientation, your nationality, your socioeconomic background. Like, there's so many different things that can make you different. And it's not easy. I think historically, tech companies have been not the best at tackling this diversity issue, though they've been speaking about it a lot. And as an executive, I've tried as much as I could in the companies that I was running to change things. But it is complicated because it is rooted in a culture that deeply believes that meritocracy is important, which, by the way, I agree 100% with, but which also believes that meritocracy as it exists right now actually works. And then you look around the room and you say, wait a minute, okay, let's assume that meritocracy works. But so when I look around me, I can only see white and Asian male, usually between the age of 25 and 40. By the time they're 40, they're actually really old. So are you telling me that basically these are the only people who are actually smart enough to make it up there? Because if that's what you're telling me, we got to have a conversation. And if this is not what you're telling me, then we got to figure out how we get other people part of our success.
Well, the thing that sort of could create this pretty massive shift in sort of tech culture is the kind of foundation being laid amid the pandemic, potentially to kind of create a more of a remote work-based culture at big tech companies and startups rather than an office culture. You know, one issue I think that you pointed out in your book is like the sense of entitlement from both tech companies and employees, in part, you know, among many other things, born out of the fact that their offices are sort of sealed off from the outside world. They have cafeterias and gyms, et cetera. How do you think that changes with tech companies shifting to more remote work, you know, including some companies for the long haul, potentially like Facebook and Twitter and several other firms that have announced more long-term plans?
I'm not sure, unfortunately, that remote working is going to solve that problem. I think it may actually make it even worse because by definition, people are more isolated, not just tech workers, but everyone. I'm hoping that somehow, as we're having more and more of these conversations, tech leaderships and tech employees are going to want to do a lot more in terms of, again, being more human focused. I suspect that it will take more than just this basic conversation, and that we may need governments or regulators to be involved. We may need users to be significantly more vocal and active on explaining what they are okay with and what they're not okay with. We probably need the media to continue to do what they've been doing. I think it's important that we talk about the good. We also really need to talk about the bad and the ugly, and the media will play a key role in that.
Well, Mael was an executive at Compass Booking and Ozon. Her book is called Trampled by Unicorns. It's about empathy, it's about management, it's about tech and policy. Mael, thanks so much for coming on the show.
All right.
That's our show this week. I appreciate you listening. And thanks to Tom and Mael for joining me on the show, which was produced, as always, by Ariella Markowitz. Talk to you next week.